This talk is brought to you by GreatCatholicWebsites.com. 56 million Catholics use the web. Are you reaching them? For web design, audios and videos, and online publicity, go to GreatCatholicWebsites.com. This talk is by Tim Murnan, a metallurgical engineer and an expert in intelligent design. He is speaking at a conference for the Kolbe Center for the Study of Creation.
He has a great scientific background, but he also has a deep personal interest in the whole origins controversy and has studied deeply not just the natural science side of it, but also the theological side. And he's going to now present to you at least part of the evidence that is not consistent with the claims of the theory of evolution.
Thank you, Yu. Again, my name is Tim Murnan, and I am from Philadelphia. And I am the father of nine children, and so I agree with the last part of Yu's presentation there on Amana Vitae. I've been an engineer, as Yu says, for 40 years. I work for a chemical company. I've been a student of the creation-evolution debate for probably 38 years, going back to a personal crisis of faith in my own life. So I'm here today to share with you some of the really exciting things that have been discovered in science, which backs up and verifies Catholic teaching. And towards the end, I want to talk a little bit about why this is important for Catholics. Back in October, just this past October in Philadelphia, we had a conference in Philadelphia, and we titled it Evolution, the Untold Story. And you can see why we had it. It was for Catholics, to try to get Catholics to engage in this great debate. It was held at the Villanova University Conference Center. You'll see Hugh Owen up here as one of the presenters. You'll also see Dr. Michael Behe from Lehigh University, who's kind of the father of the intelligent design movement, and Dr. John Sanford. Dr. John Sanford is the only non-Catholic in this group, and I'll explain why as we go through the presentation. Now, what I hope to accomplish here today, by the way, what I'm going to do is, a lot of what I talk about is going to be summarizing the work of these two scientists, the second one, Dr. John Sanford from Cornell University. And what I want to talk about now, what is intelligent design all about? And I want to demonstrate that design in nature is absolutely obvious, and that there's no known mechanism for evolution, and propose that there are Catholic issues of faith that need consideration, which you, of course, has already started us down that track. Now, you've all heard that evolution is not a problem for Catholics. And I'm here to differ with that particular point of view. If that's true, why are Catholics taught that Adam and Eve, which are De Fide doctrines of the faith, are myth? And why are so many Catholics use evolution to justify leaving the church and engaging in sexual sin? After all, we're just animals evolving. We can't control those passions. And why does a higher percent of Catholics accept evolution than the general American population? And why are Catholics losing faith in the inerrancy of Scripture? And why is evolution the foundation of every new atheist book? You've heard of the four recent atheist books that are out there floating around, selling many, many copies. If the Catholic arguments, the teleological, philosophical arguments are so strong, why don't these atheists know about these arguments, and why are they not accepting them? So I believe evolution is a huge problem for Catholics. Now, before we start, I want to separate the argument about the mechanism for evolution, the molecules to man evolution. I want to separate that from the arguments for the age of the earth that you start to get into, and also from the Big Bang origin of the universe. I want to talk about the mechanism for evolution. Where did life come from? And how does it advance from one kind of creature to another? That's what we're talking about here today. There are many people who believe that evolution is impossible. It certainly didn't happen. Certainly not the Darwinian explanation didn't happen, which I'm going to explain today, but believe in an ancient earth. There's all flavors of belief up and down on these scientific issues and questions. You can be, if you believe that evolution is not true, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a young age earth believer. So I'm not talking about that in this presentation. Now, the modern theory of evolution says that Natural selection plus small mutations can change a molecule into a monkey or into a man. This is the basis of evolution. This is what Darwin posited, that we need very small changes to occur and that nature will select that because it has an advantage and produce a new kind of creature. This is what evolution says, Darwinian evolution anyway. So is this true or is it even plausible knowing what we now know in modern science? For example, I took a molecular biology course just recently, used this book. It's called Molecular Biology of the Cell. It has 1,200 pages of molecular biology that I had to read in 10 weeks, and believe me, it wasn't any fun. But in the beginning of the book, they explain both in the storage and copying of genetic information, random accidents and errors occur, altering the nucleotide sequence, that is, creating mutations. Remember, accidents and errors. On rare occasions, the error may represent a change for the better. On rare occasions. We're having a hard time finding one of those rare occasions, but it's theoretically possible. More probably, it will cause no significant difference in the cell's prospects. In other words, a neutral mutation that can't be detected. In many cases, the error will cause serious damage. Through endless repetition of this cycle of trial and error, of mutation and natural selection, organisms evolve. And since we posit that there's 3.5 billion years of this, it must have happened. We got a lot of time for it to happen, even though it's basically a typographical error problem that's causing this. These typographical errors are posited to be able to create a man from a molecule. And that leads the authors of this book to make outrageous statements out throughout the book. This is, of course, the book that's used in most molecular biology programs around the country. In this particular case, I just chose this at random. Present-day structural homologies between photosystems suggest, note the word suggest, that this change involved the cooperation of a photosystem derived from green bacteria with a photosystem derived from purple bacteria. And then this biological consequences of this were far-reaching. Now remember, we have purple bacteria, we have green bacteria. They still exist. They didn't evolve into anything else. There's another kind of bacteria that they say is the combination of these two. No proof for that. And these bacteria, according to evolutionists, these bacteria go back to the very beginning of life, 3.5 billion years ago, and we still have them. They haven't evolved into anything else. And they have very interesting niches in life, in the cycle of life. So the question is, how does this happen, or in fact, did it happen? Throughout these books on evolution and biology and microbiology, you'll see words like probably, or maybe, or likely, or presumably, or could have, or would have to have. They're common descriptions used throughout these books. And the fact is that scientists don't know how evolution occurred, and I'm going to prove that to you in a minute. Our Holy Father, Benedict XVI, very interested in this subject, and in the summer of 2006, he held a conference on evolution at his summer palace in Castel Gandolfo. And they only invited evolutionary scientists. There were no intelligent design scientists there, no creation scientists. This particular agnostic scientist from University of Vienna, Dr. Peter Schuster, in the question and answer period admitted that there's no continuum that can be produced by individual mutations. The answer is no. There are certain intermediate stages that we cannot reach with mutations, and therefore there will inevitably be big steps as well. Therefore, it is wrong to insist exclusively on small steps. That's Darwinian evolution. He's saying it doesn't work. Today, we know that only certain phenotypes exist, and therefore transitional, without transitional forms in between. He's admitting this to the Pope and Cardinal Schönborn. Cardinal Schönborn picks on this immediately. He says, wait a minute. I have seldom heard it said with such clarity that evolutionary biology has parted ways with the small steps of Darwinian theory. What then are these large steps like? Our Holy Father, at the end of the conference, returned to this theme. At the same time, it's true, the Holy Father said, that the theory of evolution is still not a complete scientifically verified theory. Thirdly, I would like to address the leaps which Cardinal Schönborn also spoke about. The summing up of minute steps does not suffice. There are leaps. The question of what this involves has to be examined in great detail. Now, I want to ask you, how many of your children's biology books have this information in it that Darwinian mechanism doesn't work? None of them. It's a well-kept secret. I took a course in paleontology a few years ago. This is the book we used. This author, Donna Pathero, is a very aggressive evolutionist. But he admits that Darwin's mechanism does not work for macroevolution. In other words, that one kind of animal can become another. He admits it. He says over the years, a number of biologists have agreed with us paleontologists in their view the origin of the major adaptive features, such as the origin of a bird wing, which is macroevolution. In other words, where in the heck does a bird wing come from? It's a different process from small-scale changes in the wing veins or bristles on a fruit fly, which is microevolution. In other words, a natural variation you see in nature. The different color of a Baltimore Oriole, for example. There's various variations of that. Beautiful bird. There are many examples of evolutionary transformations that are difficult to imagine as gradual, stepwise process. At some point, an abrupt change is required. What is the? Where's the mechanism for this abrupt change? Nobody has a clue. Naturally, the orthodoxy does not take well to the ideas of decades of work becoming irrelevant. So, there's much resistance to these ideas in conventional literature. Now, let's take a moment just to review a couple quick definitions. Well, the word evolution is a general term that is used in many cases, and it often means molecules to man evolution. That's what it typically means when somebody uses that word. But the proper term is macroevolution, which is non-life to life and life to higher life. And intelligent design takes issue with macroevolution, not with microevolution, which is change at or below the species level, natural variation. Natural selection, of course, is the survival of the fittest. Or as paleontologists know, another secret of paleontology is that it's really the survival of the luckiest. Although we do see survival of the fittest in nature. So no one denies microevolution or natural selection. No one. Intelligent design now is a higher intelligence was involved in this evolution. In what we see in the cell and in creation in general. Creationism is generally taken to mean that Genesis 1 to 11 is a literal history. If you're called a creationist, it means you take Genesis 1 to 11 as literal history. And as you explained, the traditional Catholic doctrine of creation is that Genesis 1 to 11 is a sacred history of events that actually took place. Now, it's important that we stop for a minute and talk about what microevolution is, because when you read articles in newspapers and magazines that attack creationists, attack intelligent design, they're always using microevolution arguments. Why is that? Because there are no macroevolutionary arguments. There's no evidence for macroevolution. So they use these, artificial breeding of dogs, a fish able to swim in freezing water because of a mutation, creatures that grow smaller or mature earlier depending on their environment, different blood types or skin colors, tasteless strawberries that stay unspoiled for weeks, which is genetically engineered, by the way, by plant geneticists, and bacteria, the bacteria's ability to resist antibiotics. These are examples of variation inherent in nature, but the information for that variation, it already exists. It's not new information. It already exists, has always existed. What's intelligent design? Well, you've heard of the five proofs of St. Thomas Aquinas, and the fifth proof is the argument against for design, that God exists. It was considered the weakest of the five arguments, but modern science has made it perhaps the strongest of the five arguments. You quoted scripture in a couple places, but Romans 1 is a very good place where St. Paul talks about the argument for design. Now, the abbreviated history of intelligent design, I like to talk about the agnostic, the evangelical, the Catholic, and the Jew. It kind of started in 1987 with this book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, written by Michael Denton, again, an agnostic. Intelligent design really goes back to the 60s. There were conferences and books and articles and things like that, but this book by an agnostic really kicked things off, and he's talking about the complexity at the micro level. A lot of what I'm going to present today is similar to that. Then along came a lawyer, an evangelical, Philip Johnson, who had read Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, and and he became a debater. He went out on he wrote this book. He debated a lot of the evolutionary scientists and defenders of dogmatic evolution on the debating stump, and did really, really well until he had a stroke a few years ago. But he said this was the book he had to write so he could write the next four books, which were all on the effect of evolutionary thinking on the culture. Then along came the Catholic, Michael Behe, a father of nine as well, wrote the book Darwin's Black Box in 1996, which was called one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century. I strongly recommend you pick this book up and read it. And in here, he talked about irreducible complexity. You can't pick up an article about this debate. Michael Behe is not mentioned, and irreducible complexity is not mentioned. It's impossible to read anything on the subject where Michael Behe is not talked about. Along came this fellow, the Jew, Lee Spetner, in 1997. He talked about the statistical improbability of mutation being able to be the mechanism for evolution. And he talked about the fact that nobody's ever really seen a positive mutation, even though it's theoretically possible. There's a new book out, 2009, called Signature in the Cell, again by one of the biggest proponents and voices for intelligent design at the Discovery Institute, called Signature in the Cell. And I'm not going to talk about this except to tell you that book is really an important book. It's about 500 pages, and it tells you why. You know, it gives you the science. It's very readable. Gives you the science. Then it goes into a lot of the attacks on intelligent design, not only the scientific attacks but the philosophical attacks. Now, let's talk about irreducible complexity. Michael Behe. One of the reasons why he's the father of intelligent design is because he has the ability to take biochemistry. He's a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. He has the ability to take these complex topics and bring them down to the layman's ability to understand them. And he uses, at the beginning of the book, he uses the mousetrap. And he says, okay, we got five parts to a mousetrap, and we got a mousetrap that functions. Now, what happens if you take one of those parts away from that mousetrap? You just got four parts. You don't have anything. You don't have any function. Now, remember, Darwinian evolution says that in order for the four parts to exist, there had to be a function, that nature selected that, made it part of the total genome of all the creatures, that all the mousetrap creatures, if you will. And they then had these four parts so they could add the fifth part, and all of a sudden we have a working mousetrap. Right? Irreducible complexity says no. You have to have all five parts for it to function. Now, if you look at biology and the incredible complexity in the cell, everything there is irreducibly complex, which I'm going to talk about. Now, in, of course, the book, he went into all kinds of other mechanisms. He talked about the eye, the blood clotting mechanism in the body. If you take this away, very complex, take this one little thing away, your arm will completely turn solid. You have to cut it off. Take this other little thing away, and you bleed to death. And you know we have people who bleed to death because of a mutation. He talks about many other things in the book, but that is a very powerful book. One of the things he talked about is the flagellum. Now remember, you can't see a bacteria. You cannot see it. They're all over your hands. You can't see it. E. coli bacteria, we have something like a billion of them in our intestinal system, and they have multiple flagellum. But look at you can't see the bacteria, let alone this molecular motor down there. It has all the same parts that a motor has, and this bacteria is able to use that flagellum to motor his way through the medium that he lives in. This is irreducibly complex. I have a video that I don't have time to show you, but very powerful, very incredibly complex. Lots of proteins involved, lots of irreducible complexity for this to work. So what is design? Well, it's, of course, the purposeful arrangement of parts that accomplish a function. So here we see a bunch of parts. We see randomness. We see actually entropy there, right? Entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. But here we see design. We know that somebody designed this. It's obvious somebody designed it. Even Richard Dawkins admits that everything we see in biology has the appearances of having been designed for a purpose. In The God Delusion, one of these famous four books that are out there about atheists, he says, but wait a minute. Any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only as the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. So there was no intelligence before evolution, only intelligence after evolution, the intelligence that you and I have. That's what he proclaims. That's what the atheists complain. All these books proclaim. That's what they use as the basis of their argument, evolution. Now, despite all these books, despite the media, despite all the textbooks, despite all the negative arguments that you see in negative articles in newspapers on the editorial page, American people reject evolution. Every poll that's been taken in the last 20 years shows that the American people say that evolution didn't happen. How can this be? I believe it's because they see design in nature, and I have a lot of slides I have to keep taking out of my presentations because I love to talk about the incredible design in nature. But let's go back to the agnostic, Michael Denton, and his book, Evolution of Theory and Crisis. He spends a couple pages on the lungfish. This is a fish. It swims and eats and everything else like a fish. It only lives in Africa. It has a lung besides gills for oxygen exchange. It has a lung. And as the summer comes on in Africa and the pond starts to dry up, the fish senses that and he digs a hole in the soft mud. And he goes down there, and as the water finally disappears and the clay around him, the soil around him becomes extremely hard and dry, not a speck of moisture, his body looks dry, desiccated, and dead. You can't detect a heartbeat. And yet, when the water comes back, this creature comes alive and swims like a fish. How could evolution begin to explain that? The first time the water went out of the pond, everything died. Yet, when we look in the Devonian era of the fossil record, something like 350 million years ago, very far down in the fossil record, this creature existed then, if you believe the 350 million years. There's no evidence of evolution. This is another secret of paleontology, that if there's a creature alive today that you can find in the fossil record, it doesn't matter how long ago, that creature is the same today as it is in the fossil record. Now, the temple of evolution, the modern theory of evolution, is built on the fact that scientists assume a long age of the Earth and natural selection that we observe in nature. And then the two pillars are, of course, the fossil record, which we're not going to talk about today, and the mechanism that adds information. So we have a couple questions. Where is this mechanism that adds information and it's going to add to the complexity of creatures? And how can evolution, if it's true, overcome the immense amount of time required to change a monkey into a man? And indeed, are we devolving through mutation rather than evolving to something more long-living, more powerful, more intelligent? So let's try to answer these questions. And to do that, I'm going to use these two books by the two scientists I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, Dr. Michael Behe from the University of Lehigh. He wrote a second book called The Edge of Evolution, A Search for the Limits of Darwinism, which I believe is an even more important book than his first book. And then the second book we're going to talk about, and we actually have this book in the back there, Dr. John Sanford from Cornell University, called Genetic Entropy. And you can see these books are all very recent, 2007-8, Signature in the Cells, 2009. This is very new information, or at least explained in a way that's very new. So let's look at the complexity at the molecular level. Unfortunately, if we want to know what the mechanism is for evolution, we have to look at the molecular level. That's tedious, right? People don't want to do that. Molecular biology, you've got to be kidding me. My knees are buckling. I can't understand that. It's very accessible. So you open up a typical biology book, and what do you see? You see this diagram. It's probably in every book. It looks complex. Right? Looks complex, but this is simple compared to what complexity really exists there. This doesn't begin to explain the complexity in the cell. It doesn't begin to explain where does this complexity come from. Here you see the nucleus of eukaryotes. Here you see where the DNA is located in this gray area. There's intelligence in the cell that's scientists are scratching their heads over. They can't explain from DNA, actually, but can't get into that right now. All right, so here we have chromosomes. We have this DNA. Remember, it's a speck of dust. You can't see. You can see a cell, but you can't see the genome in the cell. You can't see this speck of dust of 3 billion nucleotide pairs, 46 chromosomes in this genome. It's 46 chromosomes. So far, they've identified about 30,000 genes. When you roll it out, this helix, it's a double helix, you roll it out, it's 6 feet long, and it'll fill up 2,000, 4,000, every time you see the number, it's bigger or different. You know, if you ever saw the Manhattan phone book or the Chicago phone book and the small print and how thick it is, it'll fill up 2,000 or 4,000 of those volumes, this information. It's a binary, looks binary. It's double, there's only four different types of nucleotides that are used. Only four different types, but they're arranged in different sequences. And there's 3 billion pairs or 6 billion nucleotides. Just think of that, 6 billion. Now, of course, the information here is used to produce proteins. Proteins are what keep us alive. They do all the work in the cell. So I want to take a minute to talk about proteins. And here, for example, are some proteins at work. Here's the DNA helix. It has to be opened up. It has to be replicated to produce this RNA. So these proteins locate themselves, open the thing up, and these other proteins come, encase these proteins, and produce RNA. And this is such a fascinating thing that I do want to take just a minute to show you this particular video. Something like 100 proteins have to assemble there.
Transcription is the process by which DNA is copied into RNA in the first step of gene expression. It begins with a bundle of factors assembling at the start of a gene, that is, a linear sequence of DNA instructions, here shown stretching away to the left. The assembled factors include an RNA polymerase, the blue molecule. Suddenly, RNA polymerase is let go, racing along the DNA to read the gene. As it unzips the double helix, it copies one of the two strands. The yellow chain snaking out of the top is the RNA, a copy of the genetic message. Building blocks that are used to make the RNA enter through an intake hole in the polymerase. In the active side of the enzyme, they are then matched to the DNA, nucleotide by nucleotide, to copy the A's, C's, T's, and G's of the gene. The only difference is that in the RNA copy, thymine is replaced with the closely related base uracil, commonly abbreviated U. You are watching this process, called transcription, in real time.
Remember that evolution says that errors in that process create new creatures. That's the mechanism. That RNA, that ticker tape coming out the back end, that's where evolution happens. Mistakes in that transcription. That's how evolution occurs. How in the world could that be possible? I want to review this one more time. What did we just see? We saw that DNA is opened up and produces an RNA strand. And the RNA strand goes out into the cell and produces proteins made up of 20 different types of amino acids. The proteins are thousands of these amino acids long. Right? So a lot of complexity. A lot of Now, here's the problem. We saw the proteins opening up the DNA to produce the RNA. Maybe 100 of them were required. So we have an irreducible complexity problem here. Michael Behe, irreducible complexity. We have a chicken and the egg problem. Which came first, the proteins or the protein synthesis? If proteins are needed to make proteins, how did the whole thing get started? When the DNA produces the RNA that produces the protein. The end result of protein synthesis is required before it can begin. This is a quote from Meyer's book that I mentioned, The Signature in the Cell. Now, it turns out it's not just this protein chain that produces a protein. This is just a polypeptide series of amino acids. It's not a protein until it can do work in the cell. What does it have to do work in the cell? It has to have a shape. Without the shape, it can't bind to other proteins or other what's called ligands. These two work together to produce some work in the cell. These are not covalent bonds. They're not very strong bonds. They're not electron-sharing bonds. They're very weak. And if it is an exact fit, a hand-and-glove fit, it won't work. And if you have a mutation that produces a poorly folded or a missing polypeptide, you can have a pretty serious disease. Now, there's something like 29,000 genes, but a lot of scientists are saying there's probably 70,000 genes or even more as they understand the genome. They've mapped it. They don't totally understand it. And so far, they've produced several hundred thousand proteins. If you look in your biology book, it'll say that each gene produces one protein. So there should only be 29,000 proteins. That's what the biology books say, but scientists are discovering there may be 500,000 or even more proteins. So, anyway, you see the complexity, you see the precision that's required here. No room for error, no room for trial and error here. Precision with hundreds of thousands of proteins and 6 billion nucleotides. Now, I wish I had time to show you this. This is an image that's created from taking slices of a pancreatic cell, putting them on a scanning electron microscope, putting them on a computer, and generating a three-dimensional image. Now, remember the complexity that we saw in the two-dimensional image from the biology book, but look at this. These are all different organelles in the cell. And the video shows how, you know, it takes them apart and puts them back together. Just incredible. And if you study the cell and all these different vesicles and all the way that the cell manufactures these molecules and passes them on to the next spot, it's just incredible. There's just no way every single page of a molecular biology book screams out design and irreducible complexity every single page. And this is an evolutionary scientist from a university in Australia. I picked this slide up someplace. And he's wondering where this cell came from. He said, how did these stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software? Nobody knows. There's no known law of physics able to create information from nothing. Where's the mechanism? Remember, we're looking for this mechanism that adds information. Where is it? I did a study on E. coli bacteria. This is a pretty interesting argument, but I don't have time to get into it. I just want to show you that the E. coli, this is a bunch of E. coli together. This is one E. coli. In this picture, you can't see these flagellum. Remember, you can't even see it in a microscope. They have multiple flagellum E. coli bacteria. Remember, you have a billion of them in your intestinal system. They help you digest. They're fairly small genes. They're only 0.1% of the human genome size. Okay, just so you get an idea. This is the genome. It's a single loop, no multiple chromosomes, a single loop, right? But remember that all life comes from life. Nobody has ever seen life come from non-life, yet this is what evolution tells us happened. And for life to continue, it needs to reproduce itself, not just a RNA molecule or an amino acid. It has to be able to reproduce itself. So this scientist, Jerry Bergman, says that this something like an E. coli is the simplest prokaryote that would have had to be to maintain life. So, in other words, the first non-life had to jump to the complexity found in this something like an E. coli bacteria in one step. How's it going to do that? And remember, even after maybe billions of years, if you believe that, it's still E. coli bacteria. It hasn't changed into anything else. talk about variation versus mutations. Variation comes from a large and complex gene pool that already exists. Mutations, remember, are mistakes in the transcription of information that we just saw. So here on the left, we see loss of information. Here on the right, we see the addition of information. So we know that we can take a wolf and we can breed, artificially breed, different dogs from that wolf. And eventually we get down to a chihuahua. But you can't take a chihuahua and breed a wolf backwards. Why? Because you've lost information. The information's no longer there. You can't add it back in except by getting a bunch of dogs together and eventually building it back to the fact that you might be close to a wolf. If you go to the Indian reservations or if you take various types of dogs, eventually they'll look like the dogs on an Indian reservation. They all kind of go back to that wild-looking dog. Over here we have twins, one white and one black, and they look like identical twins from their facial features, but they're not. One's white and one's black. What happened here? Well, the brown parents had mothers. Both of them had mothers who were white. So they were able to add information back into the genome of these babies. So now Mendel's laws of genetics, since the information is there, back into the genome, they can produce a white baby or a brown baby. Information can be lost by mutation, remember, or by isolation and breeding. But new information can only be added if it already exists in the genome. It already exists. Where did it come from, then, if it already exists? Again, mutation from inbreeding is not good. This is a partial list of the congenital genetic defects that are bred into miniature poodles. Right? We know that we breed them. We're breeding defects in. Why? Because there's recessive genes that they all have in the breed. Then the two get together, and the recessive genes become dominant genes. Now, it's important that we stop and look at this slide for a minute because I'm going to refer to it in a minute. Basically, all mutations are eventually have to come back to a single point mutation. Single point, what's that mean? One of these double nucleotide pairs, one of them, is transcribed incorrectly in that process we saw a minute ago. So, for example, in Down syndrome, you have the reproduction of an extra chromosome. And also, you can have the reproduction of an extra gene because of a mistaken transcription, right? Now, one of the theories is that that extra gene then becomes extra function. But what happens, of course, you have an extra of anything. In humans, it makes you sick. Nobody's actually seen that work. They see genes that look similar, and they say that probably one was a duplicate of the other. But for one gene to be duplicated and now to gain new function, you still have to change nucleotide by nucleotide by nucleotide. Single point mutations. But one mutation can create chaos. And they're finding all kinds of complexity. It's not just a linear binary roadmap. It has overlapping. It has three-dimensional features. It can be read maybe back and forth. All kinds of incredible complexity they're just beginning to understand. Now, Michael Behe wants to look here with a second book at nature. He says, let's see what this Darwinian mechanism can do in nature. Let's look at what natural selection and mutation can accomplish out there in nature. He calls this the edge of evolution. The search for the limits of evolution. How far can evolution take us? And he uses the malaria virus, the malaria parasite, excuse me, not a virus, to explain this. And here you see the mosquito biting a human being, and these parasites come in, and they go into the liver, and they attack the red blood cells. And every time they reproduce, and the red blood cells, by the way, take oxygen to your blood. We need those red blood cells. And every time they reproduce in there, they produce 20 more offspring. And in a couple days, one or two or three days, you have over a trillion of these parasites in your body, a trillion of them. They reproduce extremely rapidly. Now, here's natural selection in nature in action. This is a great example of natural selection. It works. Darwin was right. What do we have here? We have malaria in the light blue, and we have the sickle cell, people with the sickle cell anemia mutation in pink. And you see the purple area, this is where the two overlap. So it seems that nature has selected people with sickle cell in those areas of the world. Why is that? Well, it turns out that sickle cell allows you to resist malaria. If both parents have sickle cell, you won't get malaria, but you'll die very young, except for modern medicine, of course, keeps people alive for a longer time. If one parent has sickle cell, you'll get malaria, but you won't die for the most part. Why is that? Well, you remember, this is the complex molecular structure of hemoglobin. This is what it looks like in a microscope. It's a cream donut. Sickle cell takes that and makes it very sticky, and it folds it over, and it turns out that it clogs up the arteries, especially the capillaries. And now you can't get oxygen to your tissues. That's not good. Now, this is what Michael Behe says. Science, in this case, science says this is a positive mutation. This is good. Why? Because you're able to fend off the immediate predator who wants to kill you, and that's the malaria. So this is a good mutation to have in that part of the world. But Michael Behe says, no, this is a burning bridge. You're burning a bridge. You're harming your genome in order to fight off the enemy. He says, this is how nature works. It breaks things. It breaks things. It doesn't build things in order to change. So this is a slide from Michael Behe that he picked off the internet, and basically it's saying, let's say the enemy's approaching and the food supply's on the other side. Well, you're willing to give up your food supply for the time being to save yourself from the enemy. You burn that bridge. Keep the enemy away. Otherwise, you'll be dead. This is how nature works. Now, a large percent of Michael Behe's book is summarized in this single slide. Remember, most mutations that we just talked about are single-point mutations. It only takes this malaria parasite 1 year to overcome a drug where a single-point mutation is needed. In other words, a one-point mutation that turns off a switch that prevents the antibiotic from doing its work. It may have to come into the cell. Maybe the switch is turned off, and that translocator that allows it to come in is closed to that particular thing. It can't come in. It turns off the switch. It only takes it 1 year. But the malaria parasite reproduces very rapidly. You remember, a trillion parasites per person, that's lots of generations. So it took malaria 40 years to conquer the drug quinine from bark of trees in tropical jungles, right? 40 years. Why 40 years? If it only takes a year to conquer a typical antibiotic. Well, because it needed two mutations at the same time, at the same place. Two mutations at the same time, at the right place, not the same place, at the right place. And Michael Behe argues that there's a minuscule probability that man could do this once in 10 million years, once. In fact, man would have to wait 100 million times 10 million years for this to happen one time. But if a monkey became a man in 6 million years, like evolutionists tell us, that we deviated from a common ancestor 6 million years ago, it's obvious that this would have to happen millions of times. Not just once, millions of times. It can't happen once in 10 million years. Why is that? Well, if you believe that there's only a 1% difference in the DNA of monkeys and man, remember there's 3 billion pairs and 6 billion nucleotides. That's 30 to 60 million mutations. But when you see this 1%, it's not actually 1% difference. That's what you see in all the articles. But what they did was they looked at the 5%, and not even all of the 5%, of the genes that actually produce proteins. They program for proteins. They said all the rest of this genes, is 95%, is left over from evolution. Those genes, those nucleotide pairs are worthless. 95%. They were positing just a few years ago, 95% of the information in our genome was now worthless, left over from the process of evolution. Now they're finding that this genome has this tremendous regulation and the ability to change the RNA that's being sent out and actually produce more proteins than one from a gene, right? So all this sort of stuff. So anyway, in those other genes, the 95% of the junk, they're looking at some of those now, and they're finding it's only 86% the same, not 1%. So think of 14% instead of 1% times these nucleotide pairs, how many mutations that would take. Impossible to change a monkey into a man in that time frame. You need much more than 6 million years if the mechanism actually works, which it doesn't. Now I want to switch over to talk about Dr. John Sanford. He was a plant geneticist. plant geneticist. He is a plant geneticist from Cornell University. He wrote this book called Genetic Entropy. And John Sanford was a dyed-in-the-wool atheist. And he believed that evolution made him millions of dollars, the mechanism of evolution. He has a lot of patents. He developed what's called the gene gun that allows you to transfer genes in plants and produce new kinds of genes. It allows you to shut down different switches in corn and allows you corn to overcome different diseases in nature. In fact, almost all the corn in the United States now is, in a very short period of time, is going to be genetically engineered. You don't know that, maybe, but that's what's happening. Farmers aren't going to tell you that, but obviously they can get more yield. Anyway, he's the guy that started it all. And he started a business on the side from Cornell University, and he sold that business to DuPont Chemical Company and made millions of dollars. And he was very proud of himself. He thought, hey, this evolution is a great thing. It made millions of dollars for me. And his marriage was falling apart. And his wife said to him, why don't we go down to the local Protestant church? Remember, he's the only non-Catholic at our conference in Philadelphia. Why don't we go down to the local Protestant church? Maybe they can help our marriage. That's what they did. He became a Christian. After he became a Christian, he's thinking about his life's work. His life's work, and he realizes that his life's work doesn't prove that evolution is real. It proves that evolution was impossible. Impossible. Now remember, entropy, what's the word entropy? It's the second law of thermodynamics. It says that order tends to disorder in a closed system or in the universe. Order is always becoming disorder. The order in the university is winding down, more disorder. And that's the second law of thermodynamics. So genetic entropy, what does this mean? More chaos in the genes? Let's see what he's talking about here. He says, wait a minute. The primary axiom of biology today is that mutation and natural selection produce new creatures. Isn't that true, he says? We know mutation happens, we know selection happens, and we know adaptation to our environment happens. So evolution must be true. And he says, no, of course not. Mutation causes degeneration, and selection fails systematically, and adaptations are superficial. What does that mean, superficial? It means that an E. coli bacteria is still an E. coli bacteria. A dog is still a dog. A fish that can swim in freezing water is still a fish. Nothing has changed. Not the nature of it hasn't changed. And mutations are bad. They're typographical errors. More than one per cell every time your cells divide. They systematically destroy information. They cause systematic degeneration. They cause cancer. They cause aging. Remember, our cells are regenerating constantly. They're dying and being regenerated. Every time they get regenerated, a mutation happens, at least one, every time. Therefore, as you age, your cells are picking up mutations. The somatic cells in your body are mutating. They're not the cells that you pass on to your children, but the somatic cells in the body, which is most of the body, those are mutating, you're aging. And as you get older, you age quickly because you're accumulating. The curve starts to go up more faster. It damages every living system and it accumulates at an escalating rate. Now, his whole book is based on this one graph. Remember, this book is in the back, by the way. And what we see here is the frequency of different types of mutation on the vertical scale here. So these neutral mutations, zero, these neutral mutations happen frequently or slightly negative, and they can't really be detected, and therefore they can't be selected by nature. He says that he exaggerates the positive, the theoretically positive mutation. If you actually showed what this truly was, you wouldn't be able to see it on the graph. Theoretically positive mutations that no one has ever identified, a truly positive information-adding mutation. No one has ever identified. There are mutations that scientists and doctors believe are beneficial, but it's only the consequence of that mutation, not the fact that new information has been added. So they can't be selected either. What does get selected? Well, unfortunately, the negative mutations, and we have 5,000, 6,000 genetic diseases so far that doctors have identified. And in fact, every gene we know has typographical errors, so there's probably 29,000 genetic diseases. We just haven't identified them yet. And they cause things like Down syndrome, which is a duplication of a chromosome, a complete chromosome, cystic fibrosis. It turns out that something like 5% of the people in the world have the cystic fibrosis recessive gene, 5%. That's a lot, right? But it's pretty far from 100%. Right. Remember, we talked about the fact that it takes a long time for nature to select one mutation. So, in his book at page 126, you'll find that it takes 12 million years to fix one mutation in the genome if there are only 10,000 people. Why do you need a small population? Well, if you had 6 billion people and you had to have a mutation get captured in every genome of those 6 billion people, they'd have to have a lot of children, and those children would have to intermarry and have a lot of children all across the face of the earth. How long would it take 6 billion people to gain a mutation for everybody in the world? Nobody can count. Nobody could calculate that. I mean, they can, of course. Engineers could. But it would take one heck of a long time. Now, why do we need a small number? Because we need a small number of people so that they can interbreed and pass this mutation around. Well, what happens when, of course, a small group of people interbreed? The church says you can't marry until your third cousin or something like that, right? Because of mutation. Nothing against the natural law there, but it's really the mutation problem that we're trying to avoid. And in fact, in Pennsylvania, we have 70 German families came over and started the Amish country movement. And they have lots of mutation because those 70 families are reproduced all the Amish. They have six fingers, they have dwarfism, they have a lot of problems, a lot of genetic problems. So evolution says we need a small population for man to be smarter and bigger and greater and more powerful. But it's counterintuitive against the laws of nature. So this is what's happening. We're degenerating. So in order to study this, now remember Michael Behe studied what happens in nature, and what John Sanford's doing is, okay, I've observed in nature what happens in my plants, but I want to calculate theoretically what will happen. So he and five other scientists put together this software program called Mendel's Accountant. You can see here you can change all kinds of variables and see what the effect of those variables is. Mutation rate, the percent of positive versus negative, all those kinds of things. How many children you have, how many children survive, how many children have children, all those variables you can put into the software program and see what happens. Of course, what he sees is that negative mutations accumulate at a very alarming rate. So after 5,000 generations, we'd have 50,000 mutations in our genome, everybody's genome. The green line is the positive mutations, but it's a different scale. There's only 500 of them, and that's theoretically possible for it to happen. We just haven't identified where it's happened. And that, of course, produces this, which is a fitness over 5,000 generations. That's a couple hundred thousand years, by the way, at 20 years per generation. So over 5,000 generations, we've lost fitness. We're not as good, as strong, as healthy as we once were. Loss of fitness declines. We're devolving, not evolving. And then at the end of his book, he talks about a different model. He says, let's look at the biblical model. Wait a minute. The biblical model describes a mathematical equation. Remember that Noah, according to the Bible, lived 950 years old. Nobody believes that today. That's what the Bible says. And over here we have Shem, and these are the descendants of Shem. We have Shem living about 600 years. These other patriarchs live in a very long time. Finally, we get down to Moses and Joshua at 120. We get David at 80. And we get Jesus Christ here at the end, just to make the curve complete, at 33. So what he's saying is, this is really interesting. The biblical model is a legitimate mathematical model. Let's study that. Now, I forgot what I was going to say, frankly, but simply the fact that nobody believes this, but, oh, I know what, excuse me, the whole point of the slide, and that is that, remember that Adam had a perfect genome. He didn't have any mutations. Was it possible for Adam to live 1,000 years? Because he wasn't subject to these mutations. He had a perfect immune system. Boy, if we could get into the immune system and how that works in the human body. He had a perfect immune system, and maybe some of the diseases that are prevalent today because of mutated bacteria weren't available. So maybe it is possible. So we haven't answered our questions. We haven't found the mechanism. We haven't explained the immense amount of time that would be required. We may have answered the third question, if you agree with John Sanford, that we're devolving, not evolving. So we've seen amazing complexity and precision required, and any error causes a problem. There's no room for error. Mutations are bad. There's no truly beneficial mutations. We have the improbability of complex mutations, as Michael Behe pointed out. There's no information, no new information being added. Nobody can identify it. Where is it coming from? No gradualism from creature to creature evident in the genome. Devolution we're seeing, not evolution, and long ages needed, long time needed to fix even one mutation, let alone millions. Now, John Sanford, in his talk to Catholics at Philadelphia, used this slide to separate the science part of his presentation from the spiritual side. In my case, of course, I mix them together because I'm talking to Catholics. Now, I remember at the beginning I talked about Catholics losing their faith in the inerrancy of Scripture. So if Adam and Eve are a myth, what does this say about the authority of Scripture and actually the authority of the Church, because it's a de fide doctrine of our faith? Every Catholic has to believe it as part of being a Catholic. You've heard the name Peter Kreeft, most likely professor of philosophy at Boston College. He's a convert to the Catholic faith, a C.S. Lewis type writer and speaker, well sought after. And he wrote a book called Handbook of Christian Apologetics. And he, in here, in several places, he talks about this, but here's one quote. "We know from our experience as professors that the demythologizers of the Bible have very effectively undermined the faith of vast numbers of young Christians. For instance, we would estimate that nearly half of the students who enter Catholic colleges as believers exit as unbelievers if we define belief in New Testament terms. So here Catholic parents are paying at least 30% more to send their kids to Catholic college where they can lose their faith in Bible class." I have a daughter who is a lawyer, and one of her first colleagues out of college went to Boston College for her undergraduate degree, and then a Catholic university for a law degree. She said to my daughter, "You're the only Catholic our age that still goes to church. And you know what? I think it's because you didn't go to Catholic college. I lost my faith in Bible class at Boston College." This is John Sanford's slide. What's the heart of the issue here? He says to Catholics, "Why do you Catholics have your own schools and universities?" He says, "Isn't it because you want to teach what Jesus taught instead of what the world would teach?" He says, "What did Jesus believe? What did Jesus teach? What does the New Testament say over and over again, referring to the Old Testament? That the book of Genesis is literal history, that Adam and Eve are real, that Satan and the fall are real, Noah and the ark are real. Adam, Sodom and Gomorrah are real, and in both Matthew and Luke we see the genealogy tracing Jesus' parentage all the way back to Adam." Now it turns out, unfortunately, that Catholics are more likely to accept evolution than the American public at large. Remember I talked about that previous poll. And here's one that shows the total population in the United States, only 48% accept evolution as the origin for life. That means 52% reject it. The majority reject it every time. This includes agnostics and atheists. Let's come down here to Catholics under 30. 68% accept evolution. Who's teaching these Catholics this? That they should accept evolution when even people going to public school don't believe it? Here's our evangelical Protestant friends. Only 25% accept evolution. Here's our mainline Protestant churches, the people who are ordaining openly homosexual bishops. And who in England, the Anglican Church, ordained bishops who have previously proclaimed that you don't have to believe in Jesus Christ as your Savior, as the divinity of Jesus Christ. You don't have to believe it. They ordain them as bishops. More of them reject evolution than Catholics. What is going on here? Well, it turns out that because of that, Catholic Church attendance seems to be tracking the general population, which includes agnostics and atheists. In that 18 to 29 group, only 34% go to church. And a lot of these polls that you see about church attendance, of course, is a lot lower. If you go to England, according to our friend Richard Dawkins' latest book, something like 89% of English people accept evolution, and only 3% go to church. Tell me there's not a connection. I believe there is. You may say no. You may disagree. Sure, there's lots of reasons for this, but I believe this is the foundational reason. Our evangelical Protestants, according to this poll, these are recent polls, 2010 Pew study, something like 60% of Bible-believing Protestants go to church. So what should we do about this? We believe you should teach this controversy, both the strengths and weaknesses of evolution. But we know this dialogue is prohibited in secular schools, but a lot of court cases that say you can't teach this. Our children don't have a right to this information. In fact, it's prohibited in many Christian schools. But we do have a right to this information. Academic integrity and academic freedom demand it. Why can't Catholics teach this? Our Holy Father believes and agrees with this. You mentioned this book, Truth and Tolerance, written just before he became Pope in 2004. And in the book he says, "This dispute has therefore to be approached objectively and with a willingness to listen by both sides, something that has hitherto been undertaken only to a limited extent." He's saying, let's talk about it. Let's let both sides listen to what the other has to say. He goes on to talk about evolution. He says, within this teaching about evolution itself, the problem emerges at the point of transition from micro to macroevolution. The Pope is very aware of this. He talks about these two evolutionary scientists who are both convinced supporters of the all-embracing theory of evolution, and they declare, nonetheless, that there's no theoretical basis for believing that evolutionary lines become more complex with time, and there's no empirical evidence that this happens. This is our Holy Father himself. So in response to these concerns, all the people that were involved in our conference in Philadelphia, the organizers, the speakers, and most of the people there, if not all of them, agreed to this simple statement. We, the undersigned, are skeptical of the claims of the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. Evidence for and against the theory should be presented in Catholic schools in the light of Catholic doctrine. We think that's a very simple request. And we hope that you agree. And we hope that you'll help us to spread this message and to make this happen. So thank you very much for your attention. This is my email address. I have my card up here if you want to communicate with me. We're going to have a question and answer period in a little while. And if you have a question you want to scribble on a piece of paper, give me your email address. You know, we can continue the conversation because this argument is extremely wide and broad. It gets so many sciences. It gets into Catholic philosophy. It gets into so many things. But that's why the conversation needs to begin in Catholic circles in a big way. So thank you very much.
This talk was brought to you by GreatCatholicWebsites.com. For your website and publicity needs, go to GreatCatholicWebsites.com.